Welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential film. This week on the show, we are looking at Lars von Trier in his divisive 2003 film Dogville. Returning on the show today to talk about Dogville is Professor Marie Wester. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So I'm going to be straight up honest with you. I did not like this movie at all. I watched it and it's extremely disturbing. And it wasn't just that. I felt the film was unemotional. It was just very cold. And the message of the film, I didn't get anything else out of it other than human beings are basically animals. And it's three hours, and it just, and the content was just so much. Like I told you, I had to turn it off after a while. There's just no message to it. The message other than just human beings are terrible people, and This is not a movie I would recommend to listeners. If you like it, I don't want to offend you, but I did not like this movie at all.
I don't think liking the movie is possible. It's not a movie you like. It's a movie you endure.
Yes,
and after it's over, you have to sort of think about what you just saw and what it's trying to say. And one of the things that I think it's trying to say is when many of us see people in need, we will do enough to look good and keep our social niceties. It's also it's a commentary on the United States. United States is Dogville. That's what von Trier is trying to put across. That people are very comfortable with like putting money in the collection plate at church, but they're really not giving or open or tolerant. It's just the things that you do to make it look like you are. And that's what he's trying to skewer. He also, it's very misogynistic movie in terms of how he treats women, and particularly Nicole Kidman. He said he wrote this on a 12-day drug binge, which, kind of answers a lot of questions, right?
Yeah, that explains a lot.
And he actually wrote it for Nicole Kidman. He had her in mind for the role. The thing about his female characters always being treated so terribly in the movies, they've asked him about that, and he says, but that they're not female characters. These are self-portraits. This is him embodying a female character and talking about what he feels like. So that's a sort of a, if you think about it that way, it's a different, he's actually achieving something different than you might have thought he was trying to go for. But the what's interesting, what I found really interesting about the movie right away, and I immediately thought, I'm not going to like this because it's so pretentious, is the lack of any sort of props or, well, not props, but setting. It's just chalk lines on the ground indicating, where you're supposed to stand and stuff. I thought, well, this has got to be some sort of weird avant-garde our town. And then it goes to the dark place because he likes to go there. But it reveals itself to be sort of genius because everybody can see everybody else. Even the scenes that are supposed to be like the rape scenes, everybody can see. Everybody knows what's going on, and that's what it's trying to say. We all know everything that's going on. We all see things that we don't do anything about. But doing it this way with this kind of set makes it really visceral. I mean, you really get it, and you really notice how people are physically turning not to see or looking and not caring. Both are terrible, but there's no denying that it's going on. That's simply not possible. So he literally takes the walls down and makes us look.
Yeah, and I was reading a little bit about that, the minimalist stage setting. He wanted to strip away, like, any style, so you're not distracted by the buildings or anything. You're just looking at the story. You're totally focused and not distracted by anything. But when you do something like this, you just have buildings with chalk outlines and streets with chalk outlines where there's no walls or anything, everybody can see what's going on. How is that not even more distracting than what you were trying to get away from?
Because that's how he does things. Everything is, let's do something strange. And the setup is, when you think about it also, the other character that you don't really see, in quotes, is, you sort of have this godlike view of everything. And given that the fact that the main character's name is Grace, and in the end, the man, the big man, comes and shows up and changes, the course of everything that's happened up until that point, there is sort of a spiritual message there.
Yeah, so it's almost like
Judgment Day.
Judgment Day, perfect. Like James Caan is sort of God in a way, where he's just like, you know, you've committed so many sins that I have to wipe you clean off the earth or something.
Yes, and the whole idea that at the end she decides that Dogville doesn't deserve to exist and obliterates it. After all we're, you know, been thinking about tolerance and inclusion and stuff, it just underscores that idea that, you know, the world would be a better place if everyone was just like us. And that's where the social commentary comes in, that obviously they're talking about the United States.
Yeah, and even if to hammer more of the point home, he during the credit sequence, he shows a lot of pictures of people who are poor, destitute, and everything, and it's set to the David Bowie song "Young Americans." Mm-hmm. So, just in case you didn't get the point enough,
right? He'll hammer you over the head with those pictures of poverty and that song. Yes,
and now some people have taken on that about it's anti-American. Some people are just saying it's anti-human. It isn't necessarily it sets place in some small town in Colorado, but it could, some people are saying it could, you know, set in some small town in like England or somewhere in Asia or Africa or whatever country or continent. It could be anywhere. They're saying it because humans are alike. That's what some people say, that it's not necessarily anti-American, it's just anti-human.
Yes, and he likes that kind of subject. He likes subjects that deal with mercy, sacrifice, mental health, which are human qualities. They're not necessarily things that only Americans are guilty of doing badly. You know, you have to imagine him as a director, though, because, you know, allegedly sometimes he would try to strip and direct scenes naked in order to provoke and agitate the cast. So if that's what he's doing on the set, you know he's hoping to agitate and offend everybody watching.
Yeah, the audience. Like, he got that out of me. I'll give him that. Like, he got a reaction out of me, because I was figuring he probably wanted me to feel like this.
Yes. Yes, he wants you to feel disturbed. He wants you to walk away wondering and thinking about what you just saw. Not feel comfortable about it, or not have anything resolved or, you know, tidied up in a nice moral way. It's all meant to be, like you said, very dark and pessimistic about the human condition and the awful things we do to each other as humans.
Yeah, and so going a little bit back to what we kind of brought up originally, like you say, it's not a film it's a film there are a lot of films I like that, you know, have a very dark, pessimistic view on human nature, humans in general. Like a film I really liked, I just watched, was called The Mist, which is based on Stephen King. Now, that one's a little bit more fantasy because it's got like monsters from other dimensions, but the main theme of that movie is that we all, like in this movie, at the end, when things are getting tough, we all turn on each other. And we do horrible things. That I still really enjoyed that movie. It's a film I would recommend. This is a film, like, it has that same thing about humans are terrible. It's just, I don't know. I feel like there's some way you could do this and make it a likable movie and not just make it like this endurance of just how much misery and horrible things happening on camera that you, like, just make the audience sit through. I just feel like there's a way he can make it a good movie and still maintain his artistic integrity and not, like, have to just make the audiences feel so horrible and miserable. I hope I'm making a little bit of sense.
You're making complete sense. Getting back for a moment to the set, Russell Crowe visited the set and said, "This demands an explanation." And Von Trier said, "Not for me." So he's not going to explain himself to you. He's not going to justify what he does. And part of what's going on here is what he calls a mediatized drama. The tendency we have today to go on TV talk shows and talk about our, you know, psychological problems and past and abuse and crime and all this kind of thing. And then also in the news to, you know, focus in on bodies when they have been hurt or killed, and like give you that close up of all the gore, but you're watching it from this distant perspective. And so he's taking that to the next level, where it's, well, we're obviously interested in watching downfalls and tragedy, so let's do it from that sort of distant perspective. And it's interesting you bring up Stephen King, because that is not what Stephen King does. He deals with the creepy and the horrible things that people do to each other, but he always gives you a character that is redeeming in some way that you can identify with, and by the end you think, you know, whatever that character tries to do to, you know, push back the tide of evil, you know, it gives you hope. There's no hope in a von Trier movie, because he doesn't give you that out. He doesn't give you that comfortable way of looking at it. The film's got to be a stone in your shoe. You've got to walk away from it feeling like that was just so disturbing on so many levels.
You give him credit. That's what he did. He did it right. I just if people are listening to this, the main idea I'm probably put onto this movie is not for me, but.
Now, Paul Bettany, who took on the part of Tom Edison after being convinced by his friend Stellan Skarsgård to take the part, has never watched the movie.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, he said the making of the film was hideous and a particularly unsatisfying experience because Lars von Trier has no interest in you being any part of the cerebral process with him. You're absolutely his puppet. So he is a fan of his movies, but he's never watched the film Dogville that he's in and has no intention of ever doing so.
I'm curious to see has Nicole Kidman ever commented? Because like I said, she's just treated horribly in this movie.
She has actually, she and Lars von Trier spent a lot of time together during production. They'd go hiking in the snow and drive around in his camper and he'd grill her about her, philosophies and things. And she really wanted to work with him. She just thought he was a genius. After working with him, though, she said, I will never work with him again. But she changed her mind later because she did have a part in Nymphomaniac.
Oh, okay.
So I think he's challenging, clearly. But I think also people are very interested in working with him because he does do things nobody else does.
Mm-hmm. You're not one thing you definitely see about this movie, it's not a cookie-cutter movie.
It is definitely not a cookie-cutter movie.
So I can see where people – And just look at the cast in this movie. I mean, Nicole Kidman, Lauren Bacall, that almost fell out of nowhere. James Caan has a cameo, Paul Bettany. I mean, just a whole bunch of people I recognize are in this movie. Stellan Skarsgård, just what a huge cast.
Yeah, a huge cast with lots of famous people, lots of Oscar-nominated people. James Caan, Patricia Clarkson. It's got a huge cast. Chloe Sevigny. There's lots of people in it that you recognize, and you start off liking everybody.
Yeah.
And then one by one.
Like, it wasn't even the first, hour and a half of this movie. I didn't hate it. Like, it was interesting. I was like, okay, I'm not sure how I feel about this, but it was interesting. And then once it starts turning into, we're just going to just treat her so horribly. And yeah, it was interesting how it takes that just complete dark turn, because I think, if you watch like half of the movie, then stop, and then the other half, you're going to be completely shocked by how a dark turn it takes the second half.
I think because it's meant to, in the first half, you're supposed to be thinking, oh, everybody's, helping. Mm-hmm. I think one of the messages of the movie is you really don't know what you're capable of until you actually have total power over another human being. Thankfully, most of us are never going to know. Mm-hmm. But, according to Lars von Trier, we're all going to the dark place.
Yeah, and I know if this film was supposed to be a commentary about human nature, look, I'm not, I understand, a lot of people who will do something, who will do bad things if they're given the power, or who will not be the true, good person that they claim themselves to be. I understand that. But in this movie, if this situation did happen where this person, woman on the run from the law, for some reason she's hiding out in the small town, I don't think it would get that. I think it's a bit way out that somebody would do that much to her, where she's being abused, she's basically being a slave, as a sex slave too, just all these horrible things. At least I don't see anybody would go that would be that dark and just that evil. I mean, maybe I'm being too much of an optimist, but
I think the fact that she starts off doing menial chores is meant to make us think about immigration and how we give crumbs to people, thinking we're being generous. And then slowly, writes her.
If you can do that for me, why don't you do this?
Yeah, exactly.
And then if they don't do it, you're just being ungrateful.
Right. Yeah, I think there is a commentary there about
that. So not necessarily meant to be taken too literally, but more metaphorically or something.
Well, note to our listeners out there, if you're on the run from the law and you end up in a city that's all made out of chalk,
don't
stop there. Mm-mm. Keep going to some other place. And, von Trier had some regrets after he made the movie because of the tragedy that happened in Norway, that terrorist, the guy Anders Breivik, who shot up that island. full of people.
Oh, yeah. I read about that.
Yeah. He said that Dogville was his favorite movie. And Lars von Trier was horrified. He said, you know, if I'd known that that was what was going to happen, I never would have made the movie. So talk about being a flashpoint for people, and some people maybe taking it a little bit too seriously.
That's
I mean, it's not meant to be like a here's a good idea what you should do.
Yeah, it's sometimes what you get with art. I mean, Helter Skelter inspired Charles Manson to go on the thing he did. So you never know just what people will take art like.
Or using Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver, yeah. Catcher in the Rye. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about the ending of the film. Do you feel that I know it's not necessarily meant to be like justice is served, but do you feel that after all the horrible things that the townsfolk did to her, do you think they deserved the massacre at the end?
Deserves a tough word. I think the movie's not really about them. It's about the quote-unquote fall from grace, or the fall of grace, because she starts off being tolerant. And at the end, she completely gives up on everybody and destroys the whole town.
And that's sort of when her change of mind, it comes with her conversation she has with her dad, played by James Caan. They talk about morals and sort of other philosophical stuff. And that part was another kind of just like it's almost felt like Lars von Trier was talking right at you about his life philosophy. Like, this is what I believe, and I'm going to write it right here in this movie. And that part is like, okay, now you're just preaching to it. Like, I already couldn't take this movie already. Now you're just putting another nail in the coffin.
But I do think, though, the ending does come as a surprise, which is hard to do. I mean, after everything that he does in that movie, you don't think there are any surprises left. Or how much worse could things get?
And what was interesting about the movie for me is I'm assuming it's set in the Prohibition era, because they're all, you know, it's 1920s, 1930s era cars. You know, the gangsters look like, you know, something from The Untouchables or Al Capone. And I was curious why this had to be set in the Prohibition era, because it feels like it doesn't seem like it has to be particularly set in the 20s or 30s. It could be, if he's trying to make this message about America, it could be set like in the modern era.
I think it's meant to evoke the idea of America being a very Puritan country. And when you think about Prohibition, you think, wow, that didn't work. Mm-hmm. Most other places, you know, haven't bothered trying to, you know, rein back, you know, the vices. So I think that's why. I think it's meant to show how America is, quote unquote, moral. Not that I'm saying that it is, but that it's an idea that it is.
So it's just kind of like saying how we might hold to certain religious values, even though other, you know, we would go against them in a lot of other times, you know, making us hypocrites.
Even humanistic values. I mean, if you take, you know, the religious aspect out of it, the idea that America's, you know, going to come help you in your war if you're on the right side, the idea that we're the world's policemen, that, you know, we have the Peace Corps and the Red Cross and all of these things, all these things that are supposed to make us, quote unquote, good. But in fact, there's, you know, the other side of that coin.
Team America, World Police. That's a joke. I had to throw that in there. But you know, another person I forgot to mention with all the cast, he doesn't appear in the movie on camera, but his voice is heard throughout, is John Hurt. And was his narration trying to make the film like a novel? Because it's set in chapters and even a prologue. Do you feel like he was trying to do a novel with this movie?
That's a Lars von Trier thing, and we should probably talk about Breaking the Waves on another date. Because
please don't make me watch another
Lars von Trier movie. It's nowhere near as weird as this. It's weird in a whole different way. All of his movies are weird in a whole new way. But in that one, he does the same thing. You know, chapter one, you know, Bess's faith. Chapter two, and it goes through several. He likes that framing. I think he did it in Manderley, too. It's a device he likes.
And I believe this film in Manderley, and there's another film that's set in it's another one of his trilogies.
Yes. That's in the Land of Opportunity trilogy.
I wonder what country he's referring to.
I think they're all meant, it's actually USA, Land of Opportunity is the trilogy's name.
Oh.
But he's only made two out of three, so it's not really a trilogy yet.
Oh, is that other one you're going to be you talked about earlier?
Yeah. Okay. Washington, I think it's called.
So we talked a lot about, you know, that stage setting, you know, very strange with the chalk and everything. Reading it, it was influenced by Bertolt Brecht, kind of the avant-garde. Who was avant-garde? I think I studied him in one of my class in college. So, anything to comment on that, or the work of Bertolt Brecht and how this influenced it?
He likes that sort of distancing thing we were just talking about, where you're watching but you're not engaged. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it Brechtian, I guess. But it he did a movie called Pirate Jenny. And that story, or at least the song, Jenny and the Song, is a drudge who works menial tasks in a small town and is treated badly. She imagines a pirate ship coming into her seafront town, burning it down and killing all the inhabitants at her command. Afterwards, they leave, taking her triumphantly with them. Hmm. So you can see that, you know, he lifted the premise of the idea directly from that. Also, and I want to see what you think about this, Quentin Tarantino, who loves this movie, says if it was a play, it would have won the Pulitzer Prize. Do you get to do more experimental stuff in theater than in film?
Feel like it's made for a play. Like, I'm sure that there are, like, if you're trying to do a setting, like in a neighborhood like this, in a play, you probably would use a lot of chalk outlines. Or
kind of like our town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Really, really weird town.
Yeah. But still, again, you would still, the audience, even more intimate because they're actually seeing it in the same area, space, actual people, not like on a TV or whatever, seeing all this stuff happen. I think that might even be more shocking to them just because they're seeing this actually happen right in front of them. I'm not sure if this would get a lot. I think it would get the same sort of divisiveness it got when critics originally saw it.
But would that help it win a Pulitzer? I mean, would that work for it?
I don't think so. Just when you have something that's divisive where half the people hate it, half the people love it, I think something Pulitzer, everybody's got to be like, this is groundbreaking, this is great. If half the people are saying, oh, this is avant-garde or this is just too much, you're not going to be able to do that. At least that's my opinion. And I don't trust Quentin Tarantino with a lot of his a lot of his recommendations. I know 2 years ago he said like this really bad sappy romantic comedy called The Intern was like the greatest film of 2015.
I didn't see that movie.
It was with Anne Hathaway and Robert De Niro. But
well, two good actors.
Yeah, but it was like a kind of one of those romantic comedy.
Oh, right. I know the movie you're talking about. Yeah. Oh, come on.
Yeah, so don't trust Tarantino with everything he says.
Not with this film review.
Yes. And so this sort of leads into my next question. There's a lot of divisiveness among critics. I was reading it when Ebert and Roper at that time, they reviewed it, they criticized and they felt it had really strong anti-American messages, and they also really didn't like just the bleakness the film had. They just said they just didn't like that. So, but you can tell like a lot. It's once again critics either love it or hate it, and I think you look at any internet review website, that's going to be what you're going to get through a lot of like fans and anybody who's seen it and wanted to talk about it.
Well, you know, the good thing is I think you can tell in the first hour whether you're going to like it. And if you're watching it and you don't like it, just turn it off because it does not get better in terms of you're not going to like it more. It goes, you know, it gets darker and darker.
Guilty.
Until it completely explodes. Now, I wanted to ask you, what do you think about the title? And do you think it has anything to do with dogma? I mean, is it Dogmaville, where you're like deconstructing film down, where you're not even going to have a set? The whole thing is done in a studio. It's all completely artificial.
I thought I just thought the term Dogville is that they're dogs, they're animals, they're animalistic, they're basically treating, you know, all the stuff they're doing towards her, like Nicole Kidman, they're not even regarding her as a human. They're saying you can work. We're not going to give you any money. We're going to make you work, do everything we say, and then you don't like it. Well, we're going to chain you up, and the men are going to have their way with you. And if you're upset about that, the women are going to beat you and break all your possessions and everything. I figured that's sort of what the term Dogville came into, at least for me.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's meant to think either they've gone to the dogs or they treat people like dogs or you lay down with dogs,
something
get
like
up
that.
With fleas, all of those cliches. But I just didn't know if you thought it was a coincidence that it almost sounds like Dogmaville.
A little bit, but that leads to Dogma 95, where you're, once again, in this film, he's stripping away everything that you would typically expect in something like a film like this.
Right. You know? So if you've heard that, if you've never seen him before, any of his movies, and you start watching, you think, okay, that's really different. Mm-hmm. That's a really different way to approach the movie. So I'm with you in the fact that I think the movie's very, very disturbing. It's I think it could be edited certainly down. Mm-hmm. 3 hours is really just too long, especially for this kind of topic. But in the end, I think it's actually kind of brilliant. I think the movie's brilliant. Mm-hmm. I think the acting in it is amazing. And I think the things it forces you to look at are tough, and they're hard. They're things that are hard to really articulate. Like, mm-hmm. how do you get across the idea that we all observe all the right niceties and say the right things, but truly, do people really care? You know, there's a lot of phoniness, really. I think we can all relate to that part of it. And how you show that in a way that makes people actually think about it is very difficult.
Yeah, and once again, I totally see where you're coming from, but I got to disagree with you just because...
I don't ever want to watch it again.
Yeah,
though.
But same here, but... I just feel like there's a better way you can talk about, like, you know, not even something like I brought up The Mist. Like, I understand that's a sci-fi movie with, like, giant insect monsters from another dimension. Like, you don't have to do something like that, but there are other ways you can do that story. I mean, horror actually is a really great medium to do that, you know, with, you know, throwing people in this horrible situation. You can talk about how terrible they can be once, you know, their backs are against the wall. Just there are, my point being, there are other ways you can do that and not basically give two giant middle fingers to the audience, you know, saying, F you, this is a stone in your shoe, another stone in your shoe, like it or something. I feel that that's what he was doing to us throughout the entire movie.
I didn't think it was actually meant to be that much of an assault on the audience except for confronting them with their, you know, hypocrisies. But remember, I mean, this is a guy who would strip naked to make people uncomfortable mm-hmm. while he's filming them. So, mm-hmm. you know, literally he's kind of stripping everything naked, you know, and it doesn't care if it makes you upset. In fact, good if it makes you upset.
Yeah, I think if Lars von Trier was listening to this episode.
Oh, he'd be so happy.
He'd be so happy of what I, he'd be so happy that I feel the way I do. So congratulations, Lars von Trier. You got a rise out of me. Hope you're
job
happy.
Done.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished.
So we talked about, because when we talked about the other Lars von Trier movie we did, we talked about like what, I was curious about what the reaction of this film would be in your classes. Now, obviously, considering the content in this movie, I figured you're not going to be able to play this in classes. But if you are going to, like you said earlier, trying to bring this into an online forum, would you be considering doing that, or would even this be too much?
Oh, no, I would definitely use it online. I would make it available to my students who do the Denmark study abroad as well, because, you know, you might as well know what this guy's all about, even if you don't like him. You know, find out, and then, you know, you can put it down if you don't like him, but it's worth knowing. And he is very influential, so skipping over him's not an option.
Yeah, and I will say that, like, you have to... Like any one of his movies, you probably should see just to see what he is as a director and why he's talked about. I would say, even if you don't like his movies, be still talked about. Like, so you obviously have to watch at least one of his movies
to gauge about him.
Yeah. So I'm getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I haven't brought up that you want to bring up now?
About Lars von Trier,
or just anything else related to the movie?
Actually, there was another anecdote about. Bettany, because he wasn't interested in working with Lars von Trier, and Stellan Skarsgård told him, oh, you know, you got to work with him, he's really funny. So, you know, he took the part, and then he said to Skarsgård, what are you talking about, he's not funny at all. He said, I know, but you wouldn't have taken the part if I told you the truth. And, you know, he's really influential, and you really should work with him. I mean, at least make one film. You know, it's something you should do as an actor.
Yeah, once again, you get all these A-list actors and actresses in this movie. It seems like they all, in a way, wanted to work with him. Even somebody like, which was out of nowhere, Lauren Bacall. I mean, this time she's already a legend and been in the business a long time. But even she wanted. It seems like she wanted to work with him.
Yeah, it's a rogues gallery of famous people who are like going to the dark place. Mm-hmm. And not because their careers are washed up and it's some sort of like bad Vegas sort of situation. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, God, we have to make this movie to pay the bills. No, it's a creative choice, clearly.
Definitely.
Although, like I said, Paul Bettany didn't want to watch it.
And Nicole Kidman doesn't want to work with him again. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about the very divisive film Dogville, directed by Lars von Trier. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhead, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying so long, and we will see you next week.